Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The emergency landing of a Southwest flight on Friday has raised new concerns about airline safety. The FAA has since called for changes in the way some aging aircraft are maintained and checked worldwide. Joining me to talk about the risks of air travel today, Lee Collins of the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association, Ashley Halsey of the Washington Post, and Stephen Wallace, former director of the FAA Office of Accident Investigation. Joining us from a studio in Charleston, South Carolina, Mary Schiavo, an aviation attorney who formerly worked for the U.S. Department of Transportation. I know many of you have been reading and hearing about close encounters and concerns about airline traffic safety, so we'll be taking your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to hear your voice, Mary Schiavo. Ashley Halsey, describe the incident that happened on Friday.
A Southwest Airlines plane was flying, I believe, at 34,400 feet when a seam in the cabin, it's been described to me as if you were a passenger looking up and saw the overhead luggage compartment right next to that compartment, a seam opened up about 5 feet long and 1 foot wide. It's been described as a seam where there was an overlap and a row of rivets, the overlap intended to create redundancy. The plane made a controlled descent to, I believe it was 11,000 feet, where oxygen is no longer necessary from the oxygen masks, and then it made a landing at an air base in Arizona. And everyone was fine. There were no problems with the landing.
Lee Collins, help me to understand with this opening, how come people weren't sucked out?
Generally, the size of the opening would have been the determining factor. It was not a very wide opening. You know, I think it was some 5 feet long in length, but the explosive decompression would have been almost instantaneous, and that the cabin would have equalized, and that the oxygen mask would have then deployed, so it would put the passengers on the oxygen, and then, as Ashley had alluded to earlier, the crew would be in the middle of making a very quick and orderly descent down to an altitude where the pressurization could equalize, and that that danger was no longer apparent.
Was this kind of damage a surprise to you?
In some ways, yes, because you don't expect that very often from our aircraft fleet. They are so well-maintained and so well-inspected for the most part. But we also know that there's always the risk as aircraft get older. The more cycles an aircraft has put on it, the more times it takes off and lands, the more times that aircraft is pressurized and depressurized. It certainly stresses the metal that the aircraft are constructed out of. And so while it is surprising that you don't expect it to happen, when it does, you understand that there is the reality that it could.
Mary Schiavo, do you think that this incident was specific to Southwest, or are there lots of other planes out there who are running the same kind of risk?
Well, there are lots of other planes out there that are running the same kind of risk, and this has happened before. What's disturbing that it happened to Southwest is that it's the second time it happened to Southwest in 2 years. And given the very large fine that Southwest paid after the last hole that it suffered in the fuselage, in one of the fuselages, and given that Congress actually had hearings about what was going on with Southwest and Southwest maintenance, it was disturbing, particularly that it was Southwest. But given their, you know, their hallmark 20-minute turn and the number of flights they get out of each aircraft today, between 6 and 8, it is really at the top of the utilization scale in the industry. So it was surprising that it was Southwest, but there are many planes out there that could suffer this, and it was surprising it was Southwest only because they had one 2 years ago.
And Steve Wallace, given that they had had one incident like this 2 years ago, why wasn't this part of their routine inspection?
Well, this airplane clearly had all the required inspections done because they did have some legal difficulties and enforcement actions a couple of years ago involving compliance with airworthiness directives. So the inspections were all done on this airplane. But I will say this is a failure that the community sort of collectively did not exactly anticipate. The airplane is designed so that if there is a structural failure, it'll turn a corner at some point and vent harmlessly. Of course, the big wake-up call on this issue was Aloha.
What do you mean, vent harmlessly?
That if there's a tear along a lap joint or a rivet line, that it'll come to a point where it'll make a 90-degree turn and the skin will actually open up and it will vent and the plane will depressurize, but you wouldn't expect to have a hole the size of the one that was described accurately by Ashley earlier. So this was a far worse tear. The industry continues, the community continues to learn. The FAA yesterday mandated further inspections on these airplanes, and there are about, I think, 180 of these older model 737s in the fleet.
Older model 737. So what does that mean, Ashley? Many, many more inspections than have previously taken place?
Certainly so. I believe that this particular aircraft, the 737, was started in 1968, and it is the workhorse of the domestic air carrier fleet. There are more than 1,200 of them in service by U.S. carriers. I think with all aircraft and with virtually everything, things break. And so it's important to continue these inspections. I think the FAA has reacted very swiftly with its inspection order, and I think that they're going to continue in conjunction with the NTSB in looking at aircraft and determining whether, as Robert Zumwalt of the FAA or the NTSB said the other day, whether we need to reexamine how the frequency with which these inspections are conducted.
Okay.
May I add?
Sure. Go ahead.
Mary,
Steve.
Mary made a good point earlier about the cycles. It really is a matter of cycles. The wear on the fuselage is up and down. The worst case was Aloha, 20-minute cycles in a corrosive salt air environment. This airplane that had the failure had cycle and times that made it look like its average cycle was slightly over an hour, but still the cycles are very much, it's the pressurization cycles as Robert Zumwalt described it the other day. If you bend a paperclip back and forth enough times, it breaks if you flex this airplane up and down. So the directive the FAA put out has three thresholds. Basically, those airplanes that are under 30,000 cycles, that's pressurization cycles, don't need to be inspected. And then there's thresholds depending on how high the
cycles. But Mary Schiaffa, doesn't it depend on the frequency with which these planes take off and land? As everybody here has said, these are the workhorses. They're doing a lot of takeoff and landing. Does that put additional pressure on them? And then how do you correct that?
Well, it does, and it's the takeoff and landing, and then once they do take off and they pressurize the plane, it's I like to liken it to blowing up a balloon. You stretch it back and forth, and you can blow up a balloon several times before it'll break. And when I was a professor of aviation at Ohio State, there was a very interesting project going on, and kudos to the FAA. I think they supported that project. But they actually cut apart an old, in that case it was a 727, to see what happens to a plane after so many years of pressurizations, many, many cycles and years in the fleet. And what they found, for example, in relating to this case, was the rivet and the screw holes, for example, over the years, they were no longer round. They had become elliptical from the stresses. And so if you can imagine, even just the rivet holes or the screw holes have been stretched, the whole plane gets stretched, which is why some planes are simply too old to fly. And that's the industry has the term tired iron, and they get put out to pasture. And so I think the FAA is going to have to address that as well. At some point, do we need a sundown on the years of service, or rather the number of cycles, takeoffs and landings and pressurizations that a plane can have? And certainly the studies have shown maybe that's in order for commercial service.
Do you think it's time to replace these planes, Steve?
The FAA just last November put out a rule on widespread fatigue damage to address just the point that Mary is making. And so it requires that all manufacturers of new planes and the existing planes, all large airplanes over 75,000 pounds, that the manufacturers set life cycle limits. And they're not actually hard limits. They're limits after which, if you want to go further, you must get a special inspection program approved. Planes are in fact, though, most often put out to pasture but for reasons of economics. They're just no longer economically viable as the technology advances.
But how do you fix these planes, Lee Collins?
Well, in fixing the aircraft, I mean, it all depends on your inspection program and what your inspections turn up. I mean, metal fatigue is something that is problematic in so many ways that I think developing new structures and new composite materials, new ways of building airplanes would certainly enhance them for the future. But taking older technology aircrafts and actually fixing them, many times, like they mentioned before, tired iron gets turned out to pasture and we move on to something new.
Lee Collins, he's Executive Vice President of the Coalition of Airline Pilots Association. Do join us, 800-433-8850. We'll take your calls after a short break. Stay with us. And the Diane Rehm Show has a photograph of the Southwest plane on our website. Go to drshow.org. It shows that there is a tear above where normally you'd be sitting and near where the luggage compartment is. But there also appears to be damage beneath the windows as well. Now, what can you tell us about that, Ashley?
I am not familiar with the damage beneath the windows. Perhaps Steve has a better handle on that.
Well, there's just a line here. I'm not I can't come to any conclusion about that. Well, it sure looks like damage to me.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen this photograph, Mary. Right.
This entire panel may have just flexed as a result. I'll hand it to Lee. As a result of the decompression, there may have been a flexing that sort of looks like it has a surface
Absolutely.
Tear there below the window line. That would be my guess.
Not too comforting. Go ahead, Mary.
Well, and also when they went back and after this happened again and to some degrees even before, they had found not just cracking in one place. What they had found on the planes is that there were other cracks on the aircraft, which was particularly alarming to the FAA and hopefully to Boeing and certainly to Southwest. And so Stephen said, when the plane opened up and when it had this rapid decompression, it would have put stress on all the other cracks on the plane and could very well have pulled it there.
Ashley, how many planes were taken out of service by Southwest? How many put back in?
I believe that they found cracks on 5 or 6 and took them out of service and returned the rest of their fleet.
What's the rest? How many?
Do they have 80 planes?
So 80 of the same manufacturer.
They have, if I recall correctly, 580 or 90 aircraft, all of them 737s. But there are generations beginning in the 1968 era. I don't believe they have any of those. But from 1968 until the current time, the aircraft is still produced. What the aircrafts affected are called the classic series 300, 400, and 500 would be their designations.
And so how many of those are still in service?
In the U.S., I think 188.
Yeah.
188, and those are the ones that are being used on a regular basis. One of our listeners says, where is the heavy maintenance done? How could they have missed such a problem if the maintenance is done outside the U.S.? What kind of oversight do they have at these stations, Lee Collins?
An issue that has been discussed now for recent years has been the outsourcing of maintenance to foreign repair stations, in this case El Salvador being one, Nicaragua being another. I know both the FAA and Congress recently have looked at the wisdom of how we do that and how we oversee those operations. There has been criticism by U.S. Groups that would have traditionally done that work, that the work is not of the quality or the specific level of intensity that they would like to see.
And why is it being done outside the U.S.?
It's cheaper labor. It's cheaper. It's more cost-effective from management's point of view, but we've yet to see whether or not it's proven out over time from a safety standpoint. One of the first calls that we heard after this went on over the weekend was that we needed to go back and look at and reevaluate these programs overseas and FAA oversight of those programs and whether or not they are meeting the standard that we expect.
Ashley.
That certainly has been an issue and will continue to be one. My recollection is that Mr. Zumwalt said that this particular plane had been inspected in Dallas.
Inspected, but perhaps repaired earlier elsewhere.
I'm not aware of any earlier repairs on this plane, although I can't rule them out.
Steve Wallace.
Well, the issue of overseas repair stations, which are regulated by the FAA, and sometimes there are treaties with the host government where there can be, if the government is highly capable, if we go to Lufthansa Technique or some of these very first-rate stations, The track record is actually very good. It obviously is very much a contentious labor and economic issue, but the track record in terms of there's never been an accident attributed to an improper repair by a foreign repair station.
Mary Sciava.
Well, actually, there has been, but the problem, and it's not, I can't say that it's related to this plane, but when I was Inspector General, and both while I was there and then after, my office did a lot of investigations, and what we found on the problem on foreign repair stations is the FAA, and God bless them, they're shorthanded. I would like to see the numbers of FAA inspectors increase, but what happens is they make the initial inspection, and then a foreign repair station may never again see the FAA, not because the FAA doesn't care, but because they cannot cover the earth. They're not Sherwin-Williams. And so what happens is they'll make this initial inspection. It's an announced inspection. They will get their certificate, and then they will never get back, or they won't get back for years. And what we found when we investigated is workforces that could not speak English, and the manuals, including on Airbus, I might add, are in English. We found that they would rely on the supervisor signing off, but the supervisors wouldn't be present for any of the work. And while places like Lufthansa might be terrific, and in fact, that was one of the places that had been looked at, and they did great work, and they had unique situations. They had great computer systems where you could enter the work done in any language, like, you know, German or French or whatever, and then it would convert into English. There was this forced conversion, so you'd have excellent records. That was few and far between. So there's a huge unknown with foreign repair stations, and that's the whole idea of FAA inspections, is to take the unknown out of aviation. So that's still a big question.
But if you don't have enough FAA inspectors, as you said, to travel the world, how can we possibly know that the work is being done correctly?
We don't. And that's what concerns me greatly. And that's why I think that we shouldn't be in such a rush to say, oh, it's okay to send things overseas. Many cases we had when I was Inspector General, it would be a very savvy U.S. mechanic. One in particular I remember who was at the United Repair Facility in San Francisco. Just by looking at the part, he realized that it was a counterfeit, a bogus part. He spotted it, and he helped us uncover a huge undercover market in bogus parts and probably saved countless lives. And it was only because he worked in the industry for 25 years. He was a great fella. And we are losing that experience.
Ashley.
I think that the issue of offshore inspections is one that Congress will certainly, it has looked at before. And I think in the context of this recent incident, we can expect that there'll be congressional oversight of it once again. With all the bipartisan bickering on Capitol Hill, there is no one who is opposed to the ultimate steps necessary for air safety, and I think we can count on Congress in this regard.
So to what extent are planes like this retired? The skin is put back on this plane, or others like it to get it back up into the air, but is it just going to happen again, Steve?
Well, the airplanes, again, are retired for economic reasons. I mean, you can replace any part of an airplane. You can rebuild any part of an airplane. So with proper maintenance, a plane can fly forever. But normally what happens is, you know, as fuel costs go up and it's a fiercely competitive business, there's a continual push for more efficient airplanes. And that really drives their retirement.
You know, as a passenger, as someone who has to fly fairly often, what you are saying about these planes going back into service after inspection doesn't give me a great deal of confidence. How much do you fly, Ashley?
I fly a great deal. I fly Southwest whenever I can, and I will continue to do so. I've written a great deal in the last year or so about air safety, and in every story that I write, I try to include the fact that we have had a very long period of time elapse since the last serious accident. When it comes to air safety, though, it's very similar to terrorism. The security apparatus can be right 99% of the time. We can catch the terrorists, and the terrorist gets through once. So the same issue applies to flying.
Go ahead, Steve.
I think we somewhere in this discussion we need to just capture the safety record of commercial aviation. Mm-hmm. And I'll do it in a sentence here. After World War II, if we just sort of take that as the starting point of modern commercial aviation, the FAA now measures fatalities per 100 million people carried. That number in 1946 was 1,400 per 100 million carried. We lost 14. In the mid-50s, we lost about 500 per 100 million. In the mid-90s, we lost about 50 per 100 million. In the last 5 years, we're down to losing about 2 passengers per 100 million carried. So overall, it's a tremendous success story. That doesn't mean that this wasn't a very troubling event, and there's more to learn. But the safety record is what it is.
Lee.
If I can add one thing, and I certainly do agree with what Steve has said, we have a very admirable safety record here. The administrator, the FAA, and others are doing an amazing amount of work with very limited resources in some instances. But one aspect of our aviation safety system in this country that's been endemic since the beginning of time has been that we are always reactive in our safety measures. We wait until something bad has happened, and then we try to be prescriptive in keeping it from happening again. People in the industry who try to point out towards the horizon and talk about this could be a possible problem, this could be something we need to look at, generally don't get the audience they deserve, because our regulators and others will say, well, has anyone been killed yet? And it's that yet that bothers me. We need to be in front of safety issues and not reactive.
Mary.
Well, that's absolutely right. And everyone on this program can probably tell you, I mean, I'll list the ones that I think are that are the problems on the horizon. We know they're the problems, but we don't have the will of the industry to respond. For example, the FAA is now looking at the regional operators after the horrific accident in Buffalo and the lifestyles that young pilots are forced to live as they move up through the system and their $16,000 a year wages. My students, after we'd graduated from Ohio State, into the regional industry, by the way, would be eligible for food stamps if they had a family. That's one problem. Another problem are the responsibilities of private operators. There's a huge concern when the new air traffic control system finally goes online, and it's going to be wonderful. It actually has the potential of making mid-air collisions impossible, and that's such a wonderful thing to have. But we will have tens of thousands of aircraft flying in the system without the required equipment to be seen. That's another problem. No one will step up and say, you know, we're going to require all aircraft to have that system. And finally, we look at something that we know is a problem that we don't address, called loophole carriers, where people literally borrow other people's what's called Part 135 certificates, and they fly sketch commercial operations and those kinds of planes that go down all the time. We all know it's a problem, but we won't do anything until there's a catastrophe. So there's much more out there than just commercial operators.
Mary Skiava, she is former Inspector General for the U.S. Department of Transportation. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many callers. I'm going to open the phones and take your calls, 800-433-8850. First to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Abby. You're on the air.
Same day that I heard a piece about Southwest safety concerns, there was another unrelated piece saying that Southwest had the best customer satisfaction surveys in terms of airlines that are canceling and combining flights and things like that. And I thought, is the only way the industry can be profitable either to put people at risk or treat them badly? And then how is that an economically sustainable industry? And then we also know that airline travel is really, really high carbon footprint. So I just think, why are we questioning the sustainability of high-speed rail? We need to be moving away from airline travel, I think, as much as possible.
Steve
and
Wallace.
And I'll take my answer offline.
Well, I read lots of op-ed pieces about the economics of high-speed rail, and it's really rather difficult in this country. We were very scattered. It works better in Europe, and you saw some states
works
decline.
Works better in Europe because we don't have it.
But you saw some states actually decline to take some of the federal money that was offered because they thought it would build a system that they would have to continually subsidize.
Perhaps a political decision as much as an economic one. Mary Schiavo?
Well, as Inspector General, I also had to work on many other agencies, but two of them were the National Highway Administration and the Federal Rail Administration, as well as Urban Mass Transit. And what was very interesting is our country's whole philosophy was different, and I think that you're right. This was a political or a philosophical decision, because in the 50s, of course, President Eisenhower said, we're going to have the national highway system. And our highway system, you know, was obviously, it was amazing as the world went. And so some of the places where they're looking to put high-speed rail, for example, in Columbus, Ohio, they were looking to put a high-speed rail from Cleveland to Columbus to Cincinnati. Well, guess what? There are beautiful eight-lane freeways running between those cities. You can drive between them in about 2 hours. Americans are not going to get out of the car. And so in this time of tight budgets, I will admit, when I was Inspector General, I questioned the expenditure of billions of dollars for high-speed rail that literally would duplicate the national highway system. What we needed to find was really high-density traffic. And in some ways, it might be a state solution. So when Ohio recently turned down the high-speed rail money, they were right, because there's not the demand and there's not enough ridership. By the way, the subway in Washington, D.C., every passenger that gets on there is subsidized by the taxpayer of $2 a ride. I don't know if that's fair, and that's a political question.
All right, let's talk about another recent air safety issue, that of the air controller in D.C.'s National Airport. What was the story there, Ashley?
It was a fairly simple story, and we have two experts in the room, so let me summarize it, and then I will turn it over to them.
You just go ahead and summarize
the,
it.
The controller on duty, it was a single controller on duty on what's called the mid-shift, and he told the NTSB that he fell asleep. During the time he was asleep, the controllers who were directing traffic into the airport, who would turn it over to the tower for landing, advised the pilots that they had what's called an uncontrolled airport, and the pilots are then, it's their decision. They're just like the captains of a ship. They need to make a decision as to what they want to do with their ship, with their plane, and they made a decision to land. So that's a summary. With that, I will turn it over to the experts.
All right, and with that, we'll take a short break, and I'm sure we'll talk further about this when we come back. I look forward to hearing your questions, comments, 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org, by the David Geffen Foundation, supporting the vital role of quality journalism in this nation's civic life, and by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Two prominent political strategists, one a Republican, the other a Democrat, on why words matter, how language is used to craft campaign messages and frame debates. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour.
Thank you.
And just before the break, we were talking about an incident involving an air controller at D.C. National Airport. Ashley Halsey of The Washington Post outlined that story for us. Steve Wallace, I know you want to comment.
Well, Ashley's summary was accurate. I would just point out that 90% of the public use airports in this country, there are about 5,000 of them, do not have control towers, and many of those that do have control towers, they're not full-time. And this is based on traffic, the nature of traffic that they have, and the traffic counts. So these pilots were instructed by the controller at the radar facility in a remote location to go ahead and treat it as though the tower had closed, and that's what they did. Mm-hmm. So clearly something went wrong here. It shouldn't have happened. The administrator Babbitt himself, a former airline pilot, said he was outraged, I think. But these passengers were not put at risk, and I'll defer to Lee.
Absolutely. What Stephen says is true, that the pilots were caught at the last minute with an unexpected scenario,
sure.
But procedures are in effect that could make that and render it absolutely safe and secure for everyone involved. I think the wider issue is, once again, we've got one person on duty at a time in a tower. Again, the issue of the FAA being forced to try to do more with less. They need to be given the resources and the manpower to do the job the way it should be done, which would never, in my view, be one person in the tower by themselves.
Mary Schiavo.
Yes, and one thing that when this happened and when I commented, I always pointed out that this was not the first time that happened. This is a problem endemic to a system where we're trying to operate with, you know, less making it more. When I was Inspector General, for example, we had a situation where a fellow fell asleep in a tower. Several planes had to land and take off without the tower, and they actually had to break the door down to get in. So it's a problem that's happened before. We had investigations where people were actually leaving the tower and going out in the parking lot to take a nap, et cetera. There are devices now that they're looking at that can wake up a sleepy controller. But I think with the problem with Washington, D.C., and like I said, it's happened all over the country, but with Washington, D.C., there were national security overtones, and particularly, for example, in 1994, a private plane flew into the D.C. airspace and flew right into the White House. So that was why it was such a, you know, there was such a huge outcry. And the other issue that people didn't focus on is the air traffic controllers that were hired after Ronald Reagan fired the striking controllers back in the 80s are now eligible for retirement, and the FAA will be facing a huge shortage. So the FAA, you know, sometimes they don't fire air traffic controllers who do things wrong because they've invested so much money in
sure.
them, and they're facing a shortage. That's going to be an issue coming up real soon.
We've had a number of emails similar to this from Ed, who says the remarks you're making all implicate Southwest Airlines on every point of criticizing the FAA's shortcomings, completely overlooking the responsibility of the manufacturer, Boeing. Ashley.
Well, Boeing has responded to this. Boeing has faced criticism in the past, and Boeing has responded to this and responded to this particular incident rather swiftly. They issued the advisory on these aircraft, and the procedure there is as soon as they issued that advisory, the FAA followed up with a directive which basically instructs, whereas the manufacturer advises, and that becomes an instruction from the FAA. So Boeing, in this particular instance, seems to have responded pretty swiftly. Overall, I think that their interest in keeping their planes safe is not lost on them.
All right. To Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Back to the maintenance part of this conversation, whether it be in-country or out-of-country. As a professional airplane mechanic, I can tell you that the FAA oversight needs to be stepped up on these outsourced maintenance companies that are doing maintenance for the airlines. And secondly, and probably a bigger problem, a good deal of the employees that are doing the maintenance at these outsourced companies are not licensed airframe and power plant mechanics, which is why they are cheaper than people doing them in-house.
Mary.
That's right. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely right. Bruce, boy, you are so right. And we have seen just a tremendous trend away from that that valuable employee resource in this country. In years past, of course, you did have to have an AP, airframe and power plant certificate, and be trained. You had to, literally apprentice. We had just a tremendous resource in this country of trained aerospace workers, and we have lost that. It's amazing when you look at the employment statistics that the United States has really lost a lot of its aerospace edge. It's gone around the world, and I hate to see that for two reasons. One, it's a tremendous valuable industry to this country, and two, if we want to maintain our worldwide edge and be literally at the top, we need to have that knowledge in this country. Bruce is so right, and I wish we would value it more highly and require it from the FAA.
All right, to Greensboro, North Carolina. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Ms. Reen. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can.
I've been in the aviation industry for 11 and a half years, and I'd like to challenge a couple assertions. One, that the mechanics who do third-party maintenance are not qualified. I was a heavy metal mechanic, which means I did heavy structural repairs. And on several occasions, we had engineers coming from the factory going, golly gee whiz, we've never seen anything like this before, and hand-holding them through this. Our level of experience is really unjustly questioned. The issue here is big industry throwing flour in our faces. Those aircraft had problems 20 years ago. 1993, there was a directive to take care after Aloha's peelbacks, the sardine can in Aloha Airlines. Right. And we did those inspections then. Boeing dealt with those issues by putting tear straps. The airlines are interested in maintaining their airplanes for safety and for uptime. They're not culpable here in that if they don't know there's a problem, they don't know to look for a problem. We provide the level of expertise through inspection and maintenance to do as we're directed by both the FAA and the manufacturer. And I think there's a lack of culpability on both their parts, wagging fingers at quote-unquote low-cost carriers. Quality issues are not there, ma'am.
Ashley.
I can't speak to this as readily as Steve can. I think that these issues come up periodically, and I think that that there is a, as Lee was saying earlier, there is a reactive culture in this rather than a proactive one. But I think Steve probably is in a better position having spent his career on this issue.
Well, it's interesting that some of our callers and Mary, others are saying, well, the FAA is understaffed. I think this week in Washington, it's a hard time to look forward to seeing the government get bigger. And so, again, and as the gentleman who just called in, I would point out here that the airframe and power plant mechanic certificate to me is not as important as in the very high-tech world we live in today. We have repair stations which have highly specialized training, and the airframe and power plant is a basic starting point credential. To me, a huge factor in maintenance that we have not discussed that should be discussed, particularly relevant to the Southwest event, is the monotony of some of these inspections where someone is given a big long line of rivets to run a little eddy current probe along or do a very careful visual inspection. It gets boring. And so we try to advance the technology to automate and use things that don't require a human to do a highly monotonous, repetitive task.
What happens when these older planes are put out to pasture? Are they sold to other countries?
Yes. Typically. Many of them are placed into storage originally, usually in the western parts of the United States where the climate is such that they can be stored and stored safely. A lot of times other countries and particularly smaller countries with industries that are growing will look for them because they're bargain priced. But other times they're just not usable. And so they're cut up and sold for scrap metal.
Ashley.
Yeah, there is in Tucson, Arizona, a vast graveyard of airplanes. It's fascinating. And I've been by it a number of times. And one of the things that's interesting about it is something Lee just alluded to. You will see a plane that looks like it's been gnawed at because some sections of it have been removed. Now, I don't know, but I suspect that those are planes that have been cannibalized to help with the repair of planes that are still in service.
All right, to Shaker Heights, Ohio. Good morning, Karen.
Hi. This is a really interesting discussion because I think it all points to how consumers in this country have suffered at the hands of deregulation in so many industries that affect us. We're dealing with an old fleet of planes. They're not maintained well. Here in Cleveland, Ohio, we had a high school. It was called Aviation High School, and it was located on the grounds of the Burke Lakefront Airport. It's closed now, but people used to be able to go and get education, and they turned out airplane mechanics. It's a sad thing that it's closed. But I think that the whole issue is deregulation. No aircraft controller should be alone all night. What if he's got to go to the bathroom, for crying out loud?
Lee Collins.
You know, this points to a much wider issue that's been discussed in recent years, and certainly 2 years ago, Captain Sullenberger and his first officer, Jeff Skiles, when they testified before Congress, they talked about how we were losing a culture of our lead in the aerospace sciences, in aviation technical expertise that we once held and held alone. There has been a lack, a dumbing down, if you will, of our appreciation for the aviation sciences, the piloting profession, the aircraft maintenance profession, and all of the ancillary professions that go into making up a safe aviation system just don't seem to be valued like they once were. And that was a call to action from them and others to say, we need to grab that back. We need to become what we once were. And I think that really points to the issue. We're seeing now some of the downline effect of losing that.
Well, what do you see happening that's going to correct these problems?
There has to be a greater call, and we at Kappa, we say we're defending the profession. There has to be a greater call from all corners to get back to where we once were in this country. One of the callers before said, do we have to mistreat our people? And I think there was one other quote she made. There were two things we do to them. No, I think what we offer them is a very safe and efficient air travel system, the safest in the world. That is what our goal should be, and I'm not necessarily sure that we can say that's our focus right now.
You know, it's interesting. We hear that here in the United States we have the best education system in the world. We have the best medical care in the world. We have the best flying system in the world. Are we losing all of that? Or, I mean, these budget cuts that people are talking about sounds to me as though we're really dumbing ourselves down. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's take a call from Lansing, Michigan. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Go right ahead, sir.
My question has to do with original design. I'm a retired manufacturing engineer for Boeing, and I think they're just a fantastic company. We had to check everything. The word was 7 times, every piece of paperwork, everything. My question is about the structure on these stretches, because I've always been amazed on how we can add. And usually, I think, if I remember right, it was 20-foot sections every time you jump from like an X-100 to or a 100 to 200, 300, and they keep stretching. They become like a blimp. And it would seem to me, I remember when we were doing that with 727s, I didn't work on the 737, I worked on the 747 and all the other models, basically. But I'm just amazed that they can stretch a 737 as far as they have, and I'm wondering if that has to do with the structural integrity.
Ashley.
Totally out of my realm. I will defer completely to Steve on this, who's the expert.
Go ahead, Steve.
Well, the gentleman's right in that they stretch all these airplanes get stretched. If you look at the little 737-100, the first came out, it looks like a little stubby thing. And now, and then it was a small plane, and it's grown and grown and grown. The 900 looks like a 707 with two engines on it. But the safety record, really, you just have to fall back and look at the safety record. Airbus does the same thing. They built the A320. They stretched it to the A321. They shrunk it to the A319. Historically, these engineers, they know what they're doing, and there's no correlation between stretching a plane and its safety record.
All right. Let me ask you, Mary Schiavo, do you see this incident leading to broader investigations of other airplanes, other airlines? Couldn't just be Southwest.
And it isn't just Southwest. What I hope happens is that people look beyond just this one instance. Lee and Steve both have mentioned that we tend to be reactive, and we look at the crash and we say, oh, we fixed this problem, and we go on. But this is not isolated. For example, I worked on the crash of Chox Airlines, the seaplane that went into Miami. And in that case, it was a 53-year-old airplane flying commercial passenger services from the United States, and the wing fell off. And that plane had not had ultrasonic testing to see it had a million-dollar paint job, but they should have jacked it up and put a real plane under it. I think that it's time that we really look into this issue of putting passengers on aging aircraft. And the reason it's so important in passenger service is because it's a punishing schedule. You load them on, you load it off, and you go flying. This is not like a museum piece. And we really have to question whether we can, get the planes out of the desert. And that happens, too, by the way, that one of the caller mentioned the planes in the airplane graveyard. I have worked accidents where they've gotten the aircraft out of the aircraft graveyard, slapped a new paint job on it and some seats and started flying it again. As a country, we need to say, look, is this what we're about? Are we about the junkyard fleet? And it's time to ask that question.
Mary, how many planes do you think ought to be taken out of action?
I actually got hate mail over this question when I wrote my book, Flying Blind, Flying Safe, because I actually propose that we do have to have a sundown on commercial passenger service planes because of the punishing schedule that you have to put them in to make money. It's an economic life. I think Stephen mentioned that, and he's right, that we value it based on their economic life, and at some point it is not economically viable. And I actually proposed a sundown based on the number of cycles of a plane. At some point, you say goodbye. It's not going to be in passenger service. Go visit it at the Smithsonian. I got
Mary
hate mail on
Schiavo,
that.
Stephen Wallace, Ashley Halsey, Lee Collins. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.